Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hey, so we're here with Garrett Buckland. He's a second generation viticulturalist. That manages 22 properties, I believe, in Napa Valley, and a long-term resident, you know, born and raised. And we're going to get to know him today. So you were born in Napa Valley?
Yeah. Well, thanks for doing this. Born in Napa Valley, almost 40 years ago, wow. Which is great.
He looks really young, by the way.
Thank you. Just down the road from here, actually, grew up on a really big ranch, one of the last remaining large ranches in Napa, and certainly in Napa County. About 800 acres. We grew a lot of grapes there and cattle. Something you don't see this day and age too much anymore. But got my start in farming really at a young age, working with my dad's vineyard management company. Mm-hmm. Which, pretty common thing in Napa to, have professional farming companies work with vineyards and wineries. But that was a great way for me to get my feet wet in the vineyards, and certainly summer jobs, things like that. So and then went off to UC Davis after high school here, and basically got a degree in viticulture and winemaking. Came back and started our company, which is Premier Viticulture, with Steve Mathiason, who's my business partner and also a winemaker and viticulturist as well. That was around 2002, and we ever since then have been working for lots of really high-end wineries in Napa, some people that have their own vineyards as well that sell fruit. Really doing technical vineyard consulting for people in Napa, and it's a good little business.
Yeah, can you mention some of your clients?
Yeah. Typically, don't talk about too many of our clients.
Yes, but, no, the ones that you can.
Right. So we range from people that large wine companies that have several hundred acres of their own, all the way down to guys with 10 acres of vineyard. And a lot of them you'll know the names of quite a bit. You see their wines around. Most of our clients are based out of Napa, and some in Sonoma as well. So we work with about four different clients in Sonoma County, some large wineries over there as well. But in general, we are we're catered to helping vineyard owners and winery owners solve the most critical issues in their vineyard, and really make the best quality wine they can from what is arguably some of the best vineyards in the world here in Napa Valley.
Well, you hear a lot that the wine starts in the vineyards. In your case, you're very hands-on, so you know exactly what that actually represents. So what is your take on this? I mean, what does it really mean to you?
Yeah, certainly wine starting in the vineyard. We couldn't do what we do if we didn't have a great raw product.
Yeah.
We spend a lot of time in the field, over 6 months of our growing season and preparatory season for building some of these really awesome products. Oftentimes we talk about grape growing being, how do I get sugar? How do I get acid? How do I get some of these different components in my wine? But what we're really doing is we're growing all of what we call these secondary metabolites in a vineyard. So things like tannin, things like different flavor compounds, those are all coming from the vineyard. And you start thinking about sort of the next level of like, hey, this is neat. I can just make a wine, but how do I make a better wine, or a wine with more of this or more of that? And that really comes down to what we do in the vineyard, what kind of farming practice we tailor, what's the best way to eke out all of the things that we're looking for out of a wine from each individual block. And it can't be done without a very comprehensive approach. We have to work with our winemaking partners and decide every single year, evaluate what's working with wines, what's working with the fruit that we have, what we need to improve, and that constant circle of improving a block. For some people, the end game is very different. Some people, some of our clients, those are 100-point wines is what they're searching for. Hmm. Some people that's, recreating their perfect Burgundy vintage, if you will. Some people, it's just making a food-friendly wine. There's different things that each client needs. But the best thing is that we can design a program in the vineyard to really eke that out. And that can't happen without a very comprehensive approach. So not only does great wine begin in the vineyard, it also begins with the people that work there as well. A lot of people talk about the concept of terroir. Mm-hmm. A vineyard site and its place is incredibly important, but the people involved with it are equally as important. Without that, we can't have the reproducibility of what we do, and then also the confidence that we're doing, making the right wines.
Mm-hmm. I'm absolutely fascinated by the concept of tweaking various bits and pieces viticulturally to produce a certain type of fruit that caters to that wish list. How much can you really, how far can you push that concept if somebody tells you, I want to reproduce a Gevrey Chambertin, a certain vintage, and you have an opportunity to taste it? How could you sort of reverse engineer it? How does it work?
Yeah, it's interesting. The reverse engineering, it's not quite that simple. There's certainly, it's what I find very helpful is picking a target. So, you think in broader terms, what sort of style of wine do we want to make from a vineyard? What style of, what do we want to recreate? And you're stuck with a lot of parameters. We have a realistic, what can the site give us? Mm-hmm. If we're in a hot area, we obviously can't recreate perfectly, the extreme Sonoma Coast type of Pinot, yeah, or something like that. So there are parameters in there, but working within those parameters, we have a ton of choices or a ton of lever points, if you will, throughout the season. And even before we actually get into the farming aspect of it, the vineyard design piece of it is really important as well. So I can take a raw piece of ground or a vineyard that we're replanting and make 7 or 8 very key decisions about row orientation, spacing, rootstock, clone, all of those things that they do have some pretty important impacts on the finished wine product, or sort of where I'm going to be in sort of general terms of what kind of wine can I make out of this vineyard. And so making those smart decisions from day one is very important. What really helps is if we have a clear goal of where we want to be, and what can the site really give us when we're designing a vineyard. And then moving forward in the farming aspect of it, we're doing, in a lot of our high-end vineyards, we're doing 300, 400 hours of work per acre, wow, of sort of intervention. That's me with a crew of guys out in the vineyard, doing things like leafing and adjusting the light environment, removing laterals, things that really, really sort of push a wine in one direction or another. So if I want a more austere wine, or if I want a bigger mouthfeel, I can make these choices in the vineyard to really get me that outcome that I'm looking for. So, moving a vineyard more than, let's just say, 20% is pretty hard. So if I said I've got a Cabernet vineyard on a mountainside, it'd be pretty hard to move that sort of one direction more than about 10 or 20%. It's going to give me a certain style, but working within that style, that's how we get to these, magic points of turning what is always going to be a 95-point wine, no matter what you do to it, getting a 98-point wine and a 100-point wine out of that, coaxing the things that we want out is really the best part of this job, and certainly designing the right program is the only way to get there.
A lot of your clients attach to that concept of scoring system and making wines that, critics and public and so on, really are into? Is it common or is it pretty rare?
Yeah, you know, good question. I think everybody wants something a little bit different. Having nice scores is never a bad thing. anyway you cut it. Depending on the reviewer, of course, they all have different preferences as well. But we do have a few clients that probably five or six that routinely get 100-point wines, and we make those. We make those wines with a purpose, you know, and so that's not only does it work well with that specific reviewer that likes those wines, but it works well with the properties that we're making those wines from. So in those cases, they're very happy with the scores, of course. But we do have other clients that scores are not terribly relevant to them. We have... in some cases, we'll have an owner that just wants the perfect wine with their meal, just wants the perfect food wine, just wants something that is reminiscent of a historical wine they were tasting, or just doesn't necessarily want the big Napa cab, and they don't need it. And that's kind of fun, being able to design a program to get one thing or another. It's amazing. It's amazing to me that we can actually make, an infinite number of wines out of the same vineyard, just based on how we treat that vineyard. We can have somebody making a 100-point wine out of 10 rows in the vineyard you see out front here, and somebody right next to it making a very different wine, but making stylistic choices in how they process that fruit or how we farm it, that's really what makes the difference there.
That's really absolutely fascinating that there's that much variance. Do you feel any pressure when you're working with somebody who's, is very wedded to the scoring system and is very, aware of it? Do you feel like you have to perform in a certain manner? And what if, Mother Nature doesn't collaborate that year?
Right. So that's a good point. We say oftentimes Mother Nature always bats last. and so... we do get curveballs oftentimes in most seasons that we have to adjust to, and it makes it hard to reproducibly get those types of scores. Mm-hmm. The good news, there's a lot of pressure for some people. There's a lot of pressure to keep maintaining that high level of score. But what's really nice is as we learn a vineyard, as we understand the limitations on a vineyard or a property, and as we build really great partnerships with the winemakers that we work with, understanding the outcome ahead of time is very important. And in most cases, we're able to see problems coming and adjust for them. But of course, there's always that 1 out of 10 years, or certainly working in Napa, we're lucky. Other places around the world have very different seasonal differences.
Yeah.
We pretty much always have great seasons here in Napa and in the north coast of California. But when we get that 1 out of 10 years, like a 2011, for example, in a lot of cases, that's the harvest that a lot of places around the world deal with on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our anomaly out of the past 10 years. And of course, it's trickier to make the perfect wine in those vintages, but it's still really important for us to make the best wine we can. And that's good when we have a lot of talent on both the vineyard end and also in the winery end. We can get really close to that goal every year.
How much do you work? I mean, obviously it varies widely, I would imagine, but with the winemakers, it's a collaborative relationship. What do you like to see in the wine, some of your favorite examples of good winemakers?
The best winemaking partners we have are truly engaged in the growing process.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a mistake for anybody in any business not to be fully involved with all aspects of the product chain.
Mm-hmm.
A winemaker that may come in a couple weeks prior to harvest and say, hey, it looks great, and all of a sudden they're going to work the magic. That works a lot of times, but it's not the most fun. It's fun being involved with people who can see the vineyard at bud break and at bloom and at veraison and go through all of the key trigger points on what we do in the vineyard to actually get an understanding about what we're making. So those My favorite winemakers are good at that, you know, working with us in season. And really, you know, in some cases we do farm by committee. In those cases where we're coming out, we're looking at something, we're talking about, you know, if I do my canopy work this way or that way, I'm going to get a certain outcome. Those are really important things to engage with a winemaking team. And in almost every case, we're making better wines when we do that.
Hmm. What are your thoughts on old vines? There's a lot of romance surrounding that. That's not always accurate. It's just, you know, the emotional relationship that people have. You've obviously worked with them. So what is your perspective on that concept? And
yeah, it's interesting. Old vineyards. I work with some vineyards that were planted in the 1800s now.
Wow.
Some Zinfandel in particular, and a bunch of vineyards planted in the 1940s and 50s. There's a character that you can get out of an old planting. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, it's not an efficient vineyard, typically. Mm-hmm. You know, we have varying different diseases in a vineyard, different viruses. I mean, you think about what it meant to plant a vineyard a long time ago. There was usually people scrambling to find different varieties or clones or just healthy plants in general. So it's really great when you can find a vineyard that has persisted through all the changes that we've had here in Napa and in California. And you can actually see those vineyards still alive and doing really well, really thriving, being 100 years old. And, you know, more than once I've had to remove a vineyard like that. Mm-hmm. And it's a tough decision. You know, we're in this to be a good business.
Yep.
We're in this to make the best wines that we can. And in some cases, you know, it's the right thing to pull the plug on an old vineyard. In other cases, it's absolutely magical what you're getting from those wines. The true character of a place can really shine through a vineyard that's, you know, in its aging years. I think the most important thing is that no matter what we do, designing a vineyard today or even 20 years ago to last as long as possible, to outlast me, to outlast even my kids, that's a goal for me. You know, how do we make a vineyard that can last for 100 plus years and not have to be changed at the whim of like the market, you know, changing the variety or changing dealing with virus or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Building a vineyard that has some flexibility into its farming system and will be sort of future-proof is really kind of, I think that's a goal of everybody these days. And I'd love to look back on this conversation in my aging years and say, wow, we made a lot of vineyards that can be, you know, that can live to 100 years old. I think that's a good mission, and that's a cool thing.
That is really incredible, because a lot of us think about age-worthy wines. It's one of the core values that I think a lot of serious winos have. But I haven't thought about the longevity of the vineyard as in designing, as you so eloquently put, in maximizing its potential for as long as possible. That's a really cool thought.
Yeah, and I think, you know, of course there's a, you know, are people drinking the wines of what we used to do in the 1800s? Probably not these days. There's a lot of things that have really changed. So it's neat to see something with some consistency stick through. And I think an old vineyard can offer that. In terms of, you know, best wine quality, not always the case. You know, there's very young vineyards that we make really fantastic wines from, medium-age vineyards that we make brilliant wines from. And there's no... if we're doing the right things in the vineyard and we're doing the right things in the winery and really respecting the style that we're looking for, we can make fantastic wines as early as their first vintage. I always like to tell the story. I do work with Warren Winarski. He's one of my clients. I'll mention that. But he, in the wine that won the Paris tasting, that was from a first year vineyard.
Yeah.
And so essentially it's first vintage. So very young vines kind of set the world on fire, which is really cool. So it's neat to see that as well. It's always fantastic when anybody has a successful wine. But to me, the thing that's most important is consistency. Vineyards can go through, depending on how they're managed, go through some highs and lows of what style of wine you're getting. If you tend to push too hard on a vineyard, you're going to get a bad outcome, whether that's an old vineyard or a young vineyard. And I think that's something that more and more people are understanding.
That's almost a human-like comparison. When you push somebody too far, you know, you have to push them just enough. But then when you sort of put them in a place where they're not comfortable, then they will underperform. And I guess the vines are that way too.
Right, right. I think there's some element of truth to that. You know, there's trying to make something that it really can't be is a problem. And to me, that really shows, as we deal with a lot of, you know, our clients' wines that are in the $300, $400, you know, $800 bottle range, the room for error is pretty low. And you can see it in a block that you try to push a little too much one way or the other. And, you know, so it's interesting. And I've learned a lot since, you know, I think when I first started in this business, it's like, we can make these plants do anything we want. And and nowadays it's like, within reason, we can have that impact.
With your experience, when you first review, if you will, a vineyard, you know, the first observations, how much of it you already know instinctually that you wind up subsequently validating, obviously, through all kinds of technical data? I mean, how much of it is your just kind of gut reaction?
You know, it's interesting. The more and more, I think, you know, that gut reaction is a really important thing. And in any business, the longer you've been in this, you can shortcut some of the things that we typically have to do to get a similar outcome. I think it's very important, though, for people to really maintain a level of consistency in how we viticulturally evaluate a vineyard. So numbers are important. Numbers are very important. We need to not be, you know, if we're doing a lot of lab testing, for example, if we're doing a lot of data collection in a vineyard, you could stare at a spreadsheet and have it send you in the wrong direction. And that's really where that gut instinct is very important, you know, not to get misled by what things are telling you, numbers and data wise. And, you know, again, a lot of what we do is experience. Having professionally worked in this business for 20 plus years, every single thing is different. I mean, I still see things that I have not seen before. And being able to ask somebody who's been in this business longer, ask some of my mentors, ask people, you know, who've been doing this for 50 years, hey, have you seen this? Oh, yeah, we saw that in 1972, you know, and all of a sudden there's this this wealth of information that we can get, not just from our technical aspect of things, but from all of our mentors and just collective body of understanding about viticulture. Very important in this business to, you know, to learn from what we used to do in the past. Oftentimes, in anything, there's always fads and these coming and going of like what's cool, what are we doing in vineyards now, and oftentimes we go back and say, well, what's that old guy over there driving the crawler in his vineyard? What's he doing? And maybe there's something to that. So learning from what other people have done in this business is incredibly important, whether that's from people around the world or people that are here in our backyard. If we're not constantly tweaking how we manage and how we evaluate things, you know, it's not fun anymore at that point.
So you mentioned traveling the world. So where have you been that really kind of was interesting to you, or was it all interesting for its own reasons?
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. My wife is French, and she's also in the wine business as well, and also in the vineyard business. She's director of vineyards for a pretty prominent winery here in Napa. And So we travel a lot. Now more and more it's with kids, of course. Yeah. So, you know, less fun wine tasting and things like that. But it's really great to see how people tackle problems in other areas or other places in the world. I put a vineyard in China probably 8 years ago, something like that,
wow.
9 years ago. And fascinating, absolutely fascinating. First off, because I don't speak Chinese. and of course, I've never been to China. And so we put a vineyard in this... in the Yellow River Valley, basically. So some of the most fertile soils on earth, been farmed for thousands and thousands of years. We're digging soil pits in this future vineyard land. And I'm there with an archaeologist from the Chinese government saying, if you see bones, you know, hold your hand up, we'll come by and pull you out of the pit. And I said, yeah, that's a good point. You know, there have been people living here and farming this for 5, 6, 7,000 years in this exact same spot, and so there's a lot of things that are just really they're just eye opening, and we don't get that so much here in the New World. Our history goes back not nearly as long as some of these other places, both in grape growing and in just other aspects. So it's just fascinating, and I think everybody owes it to themselves to try to travel to another region. Try to interface with people, whether that's hosting somebody from New Zealand here and yeah. talking about stuff. The world is a much smaller place today, and we should all learn from the problems that other people try to solve.
How did he find you?
For the Chinese project?
Yeah,
very interesting. It's they actually own a winery here in Napa.
Okay.
And so it was a very, very cool experience. And, you know, I whether that's planting vineyards in Washington or Oregon or some of these other places, I now with small kids, I tend to stay here more. But it was very fun to branch out around the world and just go and work professionally with other places.
So what other countries have you visited?
So visiting is great. I'm a big fan of not working in too many other places, but we go back to France every year with my wife and kids, and mm-hmm. and try to do you know, meet up with our friends.
Sure.
Since we're both in the wine business, a lot of our friends are in the wine business as well. But we try to include a different area wherever possible, and just do the deep dive into winemaking. I don't speak French, which makes it a little tough for me, but thankfully my wife is there.
Which region is she from?
So she's actually from an area just outside the Loire Valley.
Okay.
About 30 minutes from Saumur, which is really great Cab Franc, you know, kind of territory.
Yes.
Yep.
And now that you mentioned international travel, I have to ask you, what's in your cellar? What do you guys drink at home?
Great question. So we have an entire stack of Opus One. That's where my wife works. We tend not to drink that too often. We tend mm-hmm. to trade sometimes with friends for a little bit more. I'm a big fan of. I like to drink white wines at home generally.
Very cool.
It's and I'm always interested in trying what a lot of my friends are making. We have. A lot of friends in the wine business, folks that I went to UC Davis with, mm-hmm. All have their own wine brands, and mm. I tend to like to support them as well. So I tend to look for all of our white wines. I mean, most of what my clientele, what we make are high-end Napa Cabs and you know, very high price ranges and very luxury goods. And nice $20 bottle of Sauvignon Blanc is kind of nice sometimes.
I'm hearing a lot of New World drinking. Is that an accurate comment?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay.
I think so. I mean, I have been involved with a group of guys that I taste wine with on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. We all went to Davis together. So back in like 2002, mm-hmm. 2003 or so, we maybe even earlier, 2001, something like that, we started a tasting group. And back then we used to taste weekly, and it would wow. be a different region, you know, every week, and somebody would bring a different wine. Now with everybody it's more like monthly that we get to taste, but it's really fun. You know, we do a deep dive into a completely different region, you know, or maybe the topic will just be, you know, somebody brings a vertical of one producer, something like that.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.